I feel like sitting down this morning. Is it okay? How's everybody? Oh, I heard that from the back row. Good. You know, this topic, the longer we stay in the book of Hebrews and the more we discuss the topic of faith, the more excited I become. And I seem to just be stuck, mesmerized, you might say, and just rooted to chapter 11 and on to chapter 12. Just can't seem to, I keep wringing more and more and more things out, you know, as I study the book of Hebrews. And I hope you're enjoying the discussion and the topic too. As I've said many times before, when it comes to preaching, the topic itself has to grab me first. I don't like to preach on, that's why I don't really care so much for topical sermons. I prefer to do exegetical sermons. I prefer to do narrative style or exegetical style, where I'm digging and wrestling with a topic or a concept or a word or whatever. But I'd like to start this morning by first of all just saying that I've used a few words over the past few weeks, and you've maybe become familiar with them. Words like henotheistic and polytheistic and monotheistic, those are words used by theologians and philosophers and people who study and discuss topics sometimes that are a little over our heads. I'm not trying to use words that will confuse you or anything. But I think most of you know the word poly means, you know, multiple, many. The idea of polytheism means that there are many, many different gods. Also pantheism goes along with that too. We're getting some ringing. Am I too close to that speaker? There we go. Also, when we think of monotheism, we think of the idea or the concept of just worshiping one God, the belief that there's only one God, He is supreme God, there are no other gods. A number of religions today, in this world today, adhere to that concept, mainly Judaism and also the Muslim religion, Mohammedism, and even some in the group in the Protestant denominations also adhere to it. There's really only one or two. Most Protestant denominations, Christians believe in the Trinitarian view of God. So just kind of give you a little bit behind this whole discussion, using words that maybe you don't fully comprehend or understand, so I threw that out for you this morning. You know, I'd like to just do a little exercise here this morning, and I tried it on myself first and thought, oh, you know, maybe that'll work for the bigger group, the family, the church. Just take a moment and just relax, first of all. Some of you are have, you know, come with anticipations. Some of you have come with burdens and struggles. We've worshiped God this morning. We've opened our hearts to Him in song and in prayer. And now it's time to just do a little reflection, a little thinking about God and our relationship with Him. So just take a moment now and just close your eyes if you have to. And let me ask you this question. For just a moment, think about, in your mind's eye, the ultimate environment. Ultimate environment. Okay, just think about that for a minute. If you have to close your eyes, that's fine. I'll give you a second to think about it. Picture in your mind's eye the ultimate environment. Okay? You can use the word perfect environment if you want. Do you have it? You got it there in your mind's eye? You're thinking about it? Now transfer that image that you have in your mind, transfer it into the present. Okay? Can you do that? It only takes a split second. Okay, now open your Now open your eyes. Look around you. And let me ask you a question. Does the image that you have in your mind fit what you see around you? Does it? I don't know about you, but when I'm thinking about the ultimate environment, the perfect environment, I always go back to an experience in my life. As a child growing up in the jungles of Borneo, I lived in virtually a paradise, beautiful, pristine, perfect environment. And there's one place that I always go to in my mind's eye when I'm asked the question, you know, to picture in my mind the perfect environment, or a place of beauty, or a place of serenity, a place of peace and quiet and calmness. I go back to a little island that we used to go to every summer. We get in a little putt-putt boat and cross the channel out to one of these islands, isolated, no people living on it, only wild birds and animals and monkeys and hornbills and snakes, where we would spend a week isolated, away from everything that distracts the mind, everything that corrupts the soul, and just enjoy the serenity and the beauty. So if you ask me the question, what to imagine the perfect environment, that's where I go. Because that's part of the process that we all go through when we make decisions and we make choices and we make evaluations and we look for what is important and valuable and powerful in our lives. We often go to experiences in our past so that we can put an image in our mind to describe our present experience, our present reality. And it, whether you realize it or not, or know it or not, or feel it, you do that on a regular basis every single day of your life. Part of the process of growing up from infancy to adulthood is learning to draw on past experience, past definitions, past visual experiences and emotional experiences to define, to understand, and to evaluate what we experience right now. Okay, you understand that? Are you following me? Okay? If it was a class, I'd say, if you follow me, raise your hand. But we all do this every single day, hourly, whatever, in our lives. And it's important. I noticed it in my grandson here recently. He's turned six now. It's wonderful to be able to stand back and watch a kid grow up. It's wonderful to help them grow up, but it's also wonderful to be able to watch it too and watch the process of growing up. Last time I was visiting him up there, I noticed something that I hadn't seen before. He talks to himself now. And some people say, well, that's not a little bit scary. He talks to himself. It used to be he would just play with cars, make noises, and that was pretty much it. Now, he tells stories. Now he is beginning to build a memory bank. He's beginning to identify values. He's beginning to identify power in his life. He's beginning to develop a sense of who he is in light of everything else around him. He's already made the process from hanging on to mother's skirts to he processed over to daddy and grandpa and grandma and all the other family members and then reached out to friends that he met at daycare, friends that he met at the park. And now he's beginning to develop a storyline about his experiences. And so when he plays cards now, he very carefully weaves this story. You know, the cars don't just crash. Now the cars are driving along and they're looking and they're happy and they're playing music in their car and happy, happy, happy. And oh no, here comes another car and it's in my lane. And oh, step on the brake, you know, and skidding sideways and crashing. Now you see the difference? He's experienced life enough to the point where now he tells a story. I remember thinking about that. I remember my sister and I, when I was very young, we had this large room that we shared. And it seemed like almost every morning for a while there, I would wake up and hear somebody talking. And I'd go, what? I remember this. I was very young, probably 5 or 6 years old, and I would hear somebody talking, whispering. And I realized it was my sister. She would be over across the room in her bed, and she would have her dolls, and she'd be telling stories. So you see, we develop this ability, this sense of who we are and how we relate to the world that we live in, and we begin to tell stories about ourselves. Of course, now Sean's moved on to not just telling stories. He is now Spider-Man. He has a complete Spider-Man outfit, the cape, the whole thing. And now he is the superhero of the world. All right? He's now saving people's lives, and he is now intricately involved in being powerful. He's identifying himself as with a source of power and a source of goodness too. You know, at least he's not the Wolverine man. This whole thing is important, folks, and we're most of you are long past that point in life. You have identified who you are. You know who you are. You have a sense of identity, a sense of satisfaction, a sense of placement, a sense of values, a sense of power. And you are now, you should be at least, considered an adult. So now, as an adult, you should have no fears. Right? No anxieties, no intrepidations. No bad dreams. Life ought to be just a cruise. Right? Wrong. Because life builds on our past experiences, part of our past experiences has to do with fear, anxiety, uncertainties, insecurities, all of those things that make us who we are as individuals. And so we still struggle on a regular basis with who we are, our identity. Now, some people do a really, really great job of projecting a sense of, you know, I'm all this. You know, they have a veneer around them that looks unbreakable, untouchable, uncrackable. They are it. They are the center of the universe. By the way, that's age 2 and 3. Anybody you meet that acts like that has never gone past the age of a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. They're called narcissists, you see. And Piaget and Robertson and other great students or professors of study of the mind and the development of children and adults, they will tell you that a person that sees themselves as the center of every activity, of everything, is a person who really, in reality, has never discovered who they really are. They're still 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds. They project this image of being okay and all together because they don't have a real sense of who they are down deep inside. Okay? And so, when we talk about development, when we talk about growth, when we talk about maturity, which, by the way, if you look in your bulletins, you say, well, why is Pastor Munson spending so much time on this whole topic of faith? Well, look at our mission statement, and then look at our growth chart there, and we're at maturity, I hope. And so we're going to stick on it for a while, and we're going to talk about faith. We're going to talk about what it means to be a faithful Christian, a believer in God. Faithfulness, faith. We've talked a lot about it, but now we're stuck in a chapter, we're stuck in a book in the Bible that has a lot to do with faith and about faith. We've learned that God is gracious. We've learned that God is merciful. If you haven't learned that in your life yet, then you need to think about it. Go back in your life. Think about it. Identify where God has led you in the past, and then you'll realize where He is now. It was once said that we have nothing to fear unless we forget how God has led us in the past. So don't forget. Remember. Imagine. Go back in your mind to that time when God seemed so close and so powerful in your life, and relive that and bring it into the present. God is gracious, God is merciful, and as we've said before, Jesus is the face of grace. Okay? Grace is a free gift. All who come to God receive the gift. All who believe in God receive the gift. And that gift comes to us through Jesus Christ, His Son. And Jesus Christ then becomes the face. He becomes the identifying point. He becomes the reality of God's love and mercy for us and His grace. You get it? Jesus came to this earth. He touched the ground. He walked on through the dust of the Middle East. He touched people's lives. He healed the sick. He raised the dead. He fed the hungry. He spoke to those who were thirsty and hungry for righteousness. And He appealed to humanity on a level that was non-materialistic. And that blew the minds of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and pretty much everybody else. Because what they expected was that Jesus would come as a great powerful ruler, a great king, one with much wealth and much power, and that He would get rid of all the badness in this world and they would live in a utopia, a perfect little world, a perfect little environment. Maybe the environment that you imagined in your mind when your eyes were closed a little bit ago. Jesus came with a reality that was so infinitely greater that eye has not seen, neither has ear heard what God has in store for you. And so faith is our response then, as we've said before, to grace. Okay? It's a choice to follow Jesus Christ. It's a choice to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Choosing to follow Christ is the beginning of a relationship that ultimately leads to our spending eternity with Christ in heaven. I also remember that I shared something a few weeks ago that I want to share it again because I want you to be thinking about this. Listen to this. Choices more than conditions determine your future. Choices more than conditions. You see? Because if it's conditions, if it's the condition of your life, if it's the condition of the world around you, if it's the condition of events that take place in your life that determine your future, then we're all lost. We're all hopelessly lost. We're wandering and wandering. I keep hearing this ring. It was once said that you're only a victim of your condition if you choose to be. You ever thought of that? You're only a victim of your condition if you choose to be the victim. We live in a society that loves the concept of victimization. You know, people that can develop a concept of being a victim, they can run their entire life. They can run you, in fact. They can run society around the concept that they're a victim. They can keep you running, and they can keep society running to the point of where it wears you out. Victimization is one of the great lifestyles, I guess you would say, that some people choose. It, by the way, is very fatalistic, and it really has a lot to do with existentialism, which we won't even get into that. Existentialism pretty much teaches that there is no future, so therefore you must live now and live it well and live it in a fabulous way and get as many people on board as you can so that you can use them too.
Someone said, be careful which road you choose, because you'll be on it for the next 20 miles. This whole idea of choosing your destiny, choosing the future of your life, making a conscious effort, making a conscious choice, and choosing to follow Jesus Christ or to follow your own way is vital. It's important. A couple years ago, when I came back from Oregon, I guess that's more than a couple years ago, it's 15 years ago, I was very familiar with Orange County because I'd pastored in Orange County, and so I knew most of the roads there. And so we had gone down to visit some friends, and we were on our way back. I was driving around trying to get the right freeway. If you've been in Orange County, there's just all kinds of freeways that funnel through Orange County going west and east, but going west, heading towards L.A. I mean, there's probably almost a dozen, well, not a dozen, but pretty close to that. And there was a new one, and I wasn't quite sure, but somebody told me, well, it's a shortcut, so just take it. Well, I unfortunately got myself onto a toll road and couldn't get off. Frustrating. Probably at least 20 or 30 miles. And I finally got off after the toll roll ended. I got a little piece of paper in the mail, and it said you owe, I think it was $250, because I didn't have a pass, and I didn't put any money at the gate either. So when you decide to choose a direction of your life, remember that you're going to be on that road for a while. Make a wise decision. Make a wise choice. Be careful of your choices. Be conscious. Don't just go with the flow. We also know that faith is the process of choosing the center of our values and the center of what we see powerful in our lives. Okay? By the way, faith is strictly a human phenomena. Apes don't have to make these kinds of decisions. Animals don't make these kinds of decisions. Their decisions are driven by the instinct, by survival. Humans are the only ones that have the ability to choose, to make a choice. God created us that way. That's what sets us aside from the rest of creation, is that we have the ability to choose to follow and love God or not. Hence, our great-great ancestors, Adam and Eve, made a wrong choice, didn't they? So now we're victims and we can all just grovel in our victimization, right? Feel sorry for ourselves. No, that's not what it's about. Because we can still make choices. As long as you have a mind, you have the ability to choose. Okay? What's interesting about faith is that it helps us to fulfill the universal need to find meaning and purpose in our lives. Everybody on the face of this earth, everybody is looking for meaning in life, for purpose in life. And all are on a journey to discover that. There's a big list. I made a list, but this is not exhaustive. You have all the isms: Buddhism, Judaism, Protestantism, Catholicism, materialism, capitalism, socialism, Marxism, Hinduism, polytheism, pantheism, Darwinism, environmentalism. The list goes on and on and on. All of these are men trying to find meaning and purpose and value in life. So we're back to, I guess we're back to our good friend Paul Tillich, who says that faith is that, and I'm paraphrasing, faith is that which we place the most value in. Okay? Ultimately, what do you place the most value in your life? And what do you look to for power in your life? Okay, that becomes the center. That becomes the center of your reality. That becomes the center of your experience in your life. institutions, nations, churches, political parties, philosophies, ideologies, these are all potential henotheistic centers of power and value. Mm-hmm. Remember henotheism? We talked a little bit about that. Some of you are saying, well, I'm not a henotheist, I'm a Christian. Well, that's okay. There's Christian henotheists, there's Buddhists, and there's Muslims, and there, a henotheist is someone who has multiple areas of value in their life. All right? There are things in their life that they value, such as your job, such as friendship, such as maybe your car, gearheads. Don't ever mess with somebody's car or your motorcycle. Those are all centers of value in our lives. And for some, centers of power. Okay? The problem comes when those centers of power and value begin to collide with each other. They begin to wrestle with each other. And we begin to think in our minds, and maybe some of those areas of henotheism have let us down. We've become disappointed in them. So we no longer value them. We no longer see them as powerful in our lives. And so we have a sort of a wavering, a little hiccup in our spiritual life, in our faith. What's interesting, as a pastor over the years, I've pastored quite a number of congregations, and whenever you begin to try to challenge the congregation to stretch their faith, to expand their horizons, you inevitably begin to mess with their little henotheistic values. You get it? You see? Putting crosses up in church. People have ideas. They value that there are no crosses in the church. They're symbols that they see that are so important. They've attached themselves to. They've become centers of value, centers of power. Okay? Change the music. What do? You're messing with symbols. You're playing with the values of an individual or a group of individuals. What's interesting, as I was studying this and doing a little more research, suddenly came to my mind that God likes to do that. He likes to challenge our faith. He likes to challenge our henotheism. He said to Abraham, I'm not happy with you sitting here in Ur of the Chaldees, all warm and comfortable and feeling good and smug about yourself. I'm going to drag you out of here. I'm going to make you uncomfortable. I'm going to make you insecure. I'm going to make you everything that you don't want to be, because I need to make myself the center of your life, Abraham. You get it? Oh, but please don't mess with my comfort zone, God. How many of you prayed that one? Do we really have to give the house back to the bank? I'm just going to fall apart. I need a psychologist. People don't like their comfort zones messed with. You get it? And yet I find in the scriptures, all the way through, God constantly messing with the comfort zones of human beings over and over and over, all the way from Genesis clear through to Revelation, messing with them, saying to Israel, I need to get you out of Egypt because you're just too comfortable here. They need to pull you out of here, put you out in the desert where it's hot and there's no water and there's no food and you're all the terrible heat out there. I want to make you uncomfortable so that I can tell you and show you who I am. I am the I am. I am your God. I will provide for you. I will meet your needs. Oh, but God, we'd rather go back to Egypt. We like the onions and the garlic. We like all the spices and all the good food there. We like the big, you know, steaks and all. We like all those nice things and the beautiful jewelry we got to wear back there. And yeah, we had to work for the Pharaoh, but that was, yeah, that was okay. It was not a big deal, you know. You see what God has to do sometimes to get our attention? It's amazing. So you see that all through the Scriptures. The list of people here in Hebrews chapter 11 is a list of people that God had to make uncomfortable so that He could identify Himself as a source of their power. Men and women of faith. Institutions, nations, churches, political parties, philosophies, ideologies, these are things that we attach ourselves to. These are projects that seek to guarantee in some fashion a sort of identification and immortality for us. It amazes me. I go on campuses, college campuses, university campuses, and all the buildings on these campuses have names. Amazing. Amazing. They all have a name. Chang, Falkenberg, all kinds of names written on the side. And then I realized the building doesn't really have a name. The person who paid to have that building built has their name on the building. You see, it's a way of feeling immortal. It's a way of saying, after I die, I will continue to go on because my name is on a plaque or my name is on a building or, you know, you get it? It's interesting. We often expect these henotheistic projects of our lives to validate our value and power as humans and as persons. So we're really back, as I said before, to Paul Tillich's insistence that faith is that relationship with what concerns us ultimately. I already said that once, but in my own words, this is Paul Tillich's words. So in reality, idolatry, the worship of other gods other than Yahweh, idolatry in the Judeo-Christian sense or tradition is not so much the worship of stone idols or golden idols or pagan forms of worship. Rather, idolatry has more to do with centers of value and power in our lives. You get it? Oh, by the way, that goes for Christians too. You know? You say, well, wait a minute. To be a Christian, I have to value God. I have to value relationship with God and knowing God and studying His Word. Yeah, that's true. But along the way, we like to put up little places of worship, don't we? Little things that are symbols. We like to use these symbols to make ourselves maybe feel better, or to identify ourselves. And hence, we have so many denominations that you can hardly count them. Everybody identifies with something. They identify and they value something, and they value the power that comes from identifying with that. And so we have people who are fighting or willing to kill each other because they identify their God one way versus the other way. By the way, for people who are into monotheism and henotheism, today, they're really having a heyday right now in the world. Because, you just have to turn on your television or read the newspaper. There's a lot going on out there, if you hadn't noticed. And if I was a fearmonger, and if I was somebody who wanted to really get you all stirred up and get you all excited and get your blood pumping, I would remind you of all the signs, the plagues, the wars, all those things that we so easily attach ourselves to that at times we even almost worship. I know people who are so henotheistic, they worship virtually the theology, not the God. Oh, come on, you've met them. You've met them all. Maybe you've been that. I've been there. I know what it's about. It's all about taking our eyes off of Jesus, who is. Who is? What did the text say this morning? Look at your bulletin or look at your Bible. Jesus Christ is the pioneer. I like the way Carol chose to use a version here that's uses the word pioneer. And the perfecter of what? Of our faith. In other words, Jesus Christ is the total sum. He is the center of our value system. He should be. He is the center of our power, our source of power. If you're looking for a source of identity, if you're looking for a source of power or value aside from Jesus Christ, then you are just, you're wandering. You're just wandering. You're just stumbling along. And believe me, this world will provide for you till your heart's content. It will provide for you sources of value and power. Okay? And so the ultimate or the final extreme in henotheistic faith, we find that if you've been there before, which I have, that henotheistic faith eventually arrives and ultimately arrives in sort of a fetishism. Okay? It's narrow, it's controlling, it's abusive, it's self-destructive, it's addictive, it's all-absorbing, it's narcissistic, it's legalistic, it's unrealistic, it's demanding, it's shame-based, and it's destructive. Okay? Because the only true faith is a living relationship with Jesus Christ. That's it. That's it. And so often I find, as I sit down with fellow Christians, that I have to, and myself too, not just when I'm talking with people and counseling, I have to somehow unlearn, untangle those little henotheistic fetishisms that we have. Well, David had to do it. Yes, more than once in his life, by the way, if you get bored someday and you think your life is boring. Read the story of David. This guy had obsessions that are unbelievable. And they led to terrible sins. They led to fetishisms that got him in trouble. And led to murder. Just read the story of Bathsheba and David. Just read that one story. You don't have to read his whole life. It might get depressing. But just read that one story. All right? Here's a man of God. God even said, he is a man after my own heart. And yet this guy wandered and strayed so many times in his life. Now, there's hope, isn't there? We have to fall off of our thrones. The thrones that we place ourselves on, our alter egos on, and eat humble pie like Nebuchadnezzar did. The Bible says that he became proud and arrogant. He said, look, this is the Babylon that I have built. God said, oh yeah? Go and eat grass like a cow. And he did. Until he was willing to acknowledge that God was the center of his life and that God was all powerful. And God put him back on the throne. Simple. But so difficult. Sometimes we have to cry in the darkness and discover God, renew our relationship with Him. Like Saul, who became Paul, we are struck down from our high horses, helpless and blind. We lie in the dust and we cry out. Only then Can we begin to begin a new, a fresh relationship that will last a lifetime, a relationship with Jesus Christ? He is the author. He is the finisher of our faith. What say you? Lord, so easily we stray. So easily we are caught up in those things that we see valuable and important in our lives, and in the process of doing that, we lose our way, we stray from you, we mess up. Forgive us. Forgive us for our foolish, selfish human ways. Teach us to walk each day with our hand in your hand. Lift us out of the confusion and the selfishness of our lives and set us on a path of righteousness. Righteousness that only we can have when we have faith relationship with you. Bless us as we go from this place, as we communicate, as we associate with others in this world. Help us not to forget that you are the center and the power in our lives. I pray this in your name. Amen.